Well, good evening. Thank you for coming. My name is Rani Afsadne. I'm chairing this. I won't take up too much time. I'll need to say something, I think, about anthropology very quickly, given that I think a number of you are not anthropologists and might not be too familiar with the subject. And this session tonight has been advertised as, well, in two ways. One is anthropologists speak, and in another way as the view for anthropology. So it is the view from anthropology, not because anthropology is some kind of mathematics for which if you feed in a certain information, only one conclusion can come out. It was subtitled that way because so far the discussion in Malta concerning immigration, irregular immigration and asylum seekers has tended to involve two other kinds of knowledge. The bedrock has been reporting. There has also been a set of discourses, one of them a talk given, the last talk given under the auspices of this seminar, which might be said to fall under, broadly speaking, political theory. That is to say, ideas, arguments in which the values of liberty and justice predominate. Anthropology is not different from the other social sciences in the kinds of tools and concepts that it draws on. So it is concerned, with a kind of reporting, but also with explaining how human affairs work, and also trying to interpret what human affairs in other cultures are like from the perspectives of the people living them as social actors. But there is a kind of social division of labor, which has meant that anthropologists tend to address certain kinds of questions, partly because they're drawn to them more, and they tend perhaps to be better at addressing them, in part maybe because of experience in dealing with them. So one has to do with seeking explanations for how not just a particular society works, but how parts and wholes, even a system of societies, might hang together. And another area concerns symbolism. Now, what I want to say very quickly, since one of the speakers, and possibly the other two, I should suspect, will be addressing the issue of symbolism, that anthropologists use symbolism in a way that goes contrary to a common colloquial way of using the term. Colloquially, the term symbolic is often used to mean a token gesture. So a symbolic payment usually means you are being thanked but not being paid very much. For anthropologists, symbolic means something different. It concerns the process and the structures of perception. So a term like symbolic violence doesn't mean token violence, you know, that gentle slap on the cheek that the archbishop used to give the recipients undergoing confirmation. Now, it's symbolic violence, according to some anthropologists, can be very harsh and very painful indeed. This is to alert you that symbolism is going to be used in that particular way tonight. Without further ado, I will therefore pass on to, the words to the first speaker, who is Paul Clow, who will be addressing the question of the identity of the immigrants in Malta.
In the first part of my talk, I want to take a look at some of the global figures for African refugees and illegal immigrants in Malta, such as these figures are available. In what follows, I'm very grateful to Dr. Ruth Farrugia for her paper last week and for the evidence given in the paper she gave at the Work in Progress seminars last year. It would seem that in the year 2002, for which we have full figures, 1,745 illegal immigrants landed in Malta. They were mainly from four states in Black Africa, the Republic of Congo, Eritrea, Somalia, and Liberia. The vast majority were single men. In fact, it can be said that these countries were definitely experiencing real violence, serious, not just symbolic violence, but violence at every level, violent instability and civil war. Over 50% were given official refugee status by Malta's Commissioner for Refugees. Indeed, with over 50% of immigrants receiving a positive response to their application for asylum, Malta has a far higher rate of acceptance of asylum seekers than most European countries. Dr. Farrugia argued that one of the major reasons why they are given acceptance at such a high rate is precisely that it has been well nigh impossible to reject the application for asylum of applicants originating in Somalia, Liberia, Congo, and Eritrea. Dr. Farrugia also pointed out, based on her own research experience, that the majority of these African refugees are not the truly poor or truly marginal members of their country of origin. On the contrary, they tend to have much better than average education and have saved considerable amounts of money in order to enable them to make the journey. For example, the Jesuit Refugee Service reports from its surveys of immigrants that $5,000 is required to make the full journey from Eritrea in northeast Africa through to Italy. Most popular destinations, final destinations in the minds of these Africans seeking asylum are the Scandinavian countries first, followed in second priority by Switzerland, thirdly by Belgium, and fourthly by Germany. If given refugee status by Malta or by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, their aim is to obtain resettlement from the country representatives of the seven main receiving countries who occasionally visit Malta and vet various asylum seekers for asylum status in these countries. And these seven main receiving countries are the United States, in order of acceptance, the United States, secondly Canada, thirdly Norway, fourthly Sweden, fifthly New Zealand, sixth Finland, seventh Denmark, and last Netherlands. Now, in this part of my talk, the context I want to very, very briefly provide is this. Perhaps you are familiar with this context. Since African countries received independence in the early 1960s, there was the development of mass public education. It was a priority of the governments of these countries. As a result, a high percentage of the population in many African countries have primary education. A lower but still significant percent have secondary education. And the other point I want to make by way of context would be much better made with the help of an overhead projector, but there's competition between this room and the next room for the use of the overhead projector. I think it's very important as an overall point, although unfortunately I can only make it by showing, as it were, a small map of...
I would suggest that you would quickly describe it and then pass it around.
Okay, fine. If we look at the key areas of violent instability, we have next door to each other Sierra Leone and Liberia. Cote d'Ivoire is undergoing a military crisis of a sort at the moment, but it has a long tradition of political negotiation. There is French intervention, and I think there are some hopes that this might reach some kind of negotiated settlement. If we look across Africa, we find that Chad has often experienced turmoil promoted by the long-range political involvement of Libya. We find Sudan is going through a continuous civil war, which has lasted 20 years and has left over a million dead. We find Eritrea is involved in considerable political disturbance. To the south, as I said, Zimbabwe is an area undergoing political repression. But I think it's equally important to bear in mind that there are areas of Africa which have established a very interesting record of political accommodation, political compromise, and the gradual development and reform of political institutions. Thus, Senegal has developed a multi-party system and is in the process of overcoming a small type of ethnic insurgency from a group who felt themselves excluded. We find that Ghana is in a state of considerable economic development. There is peace in Burkina Faso and Niger, and Nigeria, the largest country in terms of population in Africa, with all of its fraught problems, still manages, a bit like India, to avoid an ultimate breakdown in its political institutions. Then again, the same thing can be said of Cameroon, which has a very long tradition of political stability under a one-party state, and we can say the same of Gabon and Congo, where there is peace. Looking at southern and eastern Africa, one should point out that Botswana, Zambia, and Tanzania have a long record of peaceful political development. So I don't think we're talking about, to put the whole issue in context, about an overwhelming pandemic African exodus. We are talking about specific areas with specific political breakdowns which need to be understood. The second element I want to address briefly concerns my own knowledge of political refugees. In the middle and late 1990s, I was familiar with a small group of refugees from southern Sudan civil war who were in Malta. They arrived from Libya by plane. They made their way to Dar l'Immigrant, where they received the Immigrants Commission in Malta, where they received unofficial protection. And through Dar l'Immigrant, they obtained work on the construction sites of the Hilton Hotel, the Western Dragonara, and other such construction sites. They waited to be processed by UNHCR. Once given refugee status, they received in Malta £90 a month for the first 6 months and £45 a month thereafter. I knew four of these southern Sudanese. One got a PhD in management from the University of Malta, worked as a manager on the new hospital site, and eventually was given political asylum in the USA. Two were undergraduate students at the University of Malta for 1 year, and then they got political asylum in Australia. The last one, who I will call Martin, had certificates from teachers' colleges in southern Sudan, spoke excellent English, and once given refugee status in Malta, moved from job to job seeking higher pay. Eventually, he owned a small motorcycle, lived near me in St. Paul's Bay, and had a number of Maltese friends. He also was given asylum in the United States. His narrative of escape from Darfur in western Sudan is interesting. As a Christian from southern Sudan with excellent English, he worked for various foreign aid missions in Darfur. He was imprisoned by the Khartoum government in Darfur, then released. But he got wind of a second imprisonment, which he felt was sinister. And in the space of a few days, he had paid the driver of a truck for the journey across the desert. In summary, these four men are from a war zone. They have good secondary or graduate education in the African country of origin. They were seeking to build a new life, not in Malta, but in a large, rich democracy to which they eventually got processed. While here, they were certainly willing to work and able to work. They were net contributors, too, rather than a drain on the Maltese economy. In the third and final section of my remarks, since we want to limit our interventions to 15 minutes, I want to take a closer anthropological look at one particular war zone in Africa. That is, to extend, as it were, our understanding of African refugees in Malta back to the areas from which they came in order to better understand the causes for which they come. And in fact, I will be focusing on Sierra Leone and Liberia, which, as you see on the map, are two contiguous countries in West Africa. And here I rely on articles in the journal Anthropology Today, which is published six times a year in London, and on a very, very interesting book written by Paul Richards, called Fighting for the Rainforest, War, Youth, and Resources in Sierra Leone, 1996. Professor Richards was Professor of African Anthropology at University College London, and now he's Professor of Anthropology at the University of Wageningen in the Netherlands. He's very, very familiar with Sierra Leone, having been there for many years as an anthropologist, and he decided to try to do an analysis of the nature of the conflict. Now, between 1991 and 2001, the civil war in Sierra Leone left 75,000 people dead. Many of you know that it was a war with particularly frightening and unusual manifestations. The guerrilla forces had the practice of amputating the hands of people as an act of terror, but with a very rational purpose, according to Paul Richards. This form of violence was directed to stopping possible enemies from harvesting the crop and living a normal life, you see, and thus providing government troops or government areas with food, or it was very nefariously designed to stop people from voting when the government decided that perhaps an election might lead to some sort of solution to the crisis. As of 2001, there are 12,000 United Nations peacekeepers spending $500 million a year in Sierra Leone. It's the largest UN deployment in the world. Fighting in Liberia, the next door country, is ongoing. And we find that in Sierra Leone, the guerrilla force, the RUF, Revolutionary United Front, has in fact been assisted in the past by Charles Taylor, the head of guerrilla forces, the warlord, if you will, in Liberia. We find that another bizarre and tragic feature of this civil war is that the guerrilla forces make use of boy soldiers, that is, children in the range of 10 to 15. And that, in fact, they are involved very often, not only in frontline fighting, but also they are the ones who are ordered to do the amputations. It might be said that government forces also apparently have over 1,000 children as their militias. What are we to make of this? Well, Paul Richards, in Fighting for the Rainforest, argues that it's not fundamentally an ethnic conflict. Rather, what we have to see is the specific political economy of Sierra Leone and next-door Liberia has contributed to the outbreak of violence which has led to the civil war. We find that in the early 1960s, Sierra Leone received its independence from Britain, but that it had a very particular social composition. There was a Creole elite, that is to say, a mixture of peoples who had perhaps been working for the British Army in various parts of the world, who had perhaps been ex-slaves in the West Indies, who returned to Sierra Leone with a certain level of westernization, a certain level of education, and they came to form, as it were, an endogamous intermarrying class who controlled all the political positions and excluded the great majority of Sierra Leoneans who were rural and from the hinterland of Sierra Leone. We find that this is what Paul Richards calls the patrimonial state. The patrimonial state exists when patron-client relations are upscaled to the national level, and so that all resources have to be allocated according to the personal decision of a particular minister among his followers in order to increase his power. So you have the real state and the shadow state. The shadow state actually controls the resources in an economy which is, and a government which is not properly audited. The official state is there for international recognition. Now, this arrangement and the patrimonial methods of distributing school education, health, and other benefits worked, as it were, fairly smoothly until the 1980s, when world recession led to a sharp decline in the price of Sierra Leone's products. These are specifically gold and diamonds. We find, secondly, that with the end of the Cold War, it became less possible for patrimonial politicians in countries like Liberia or Sierra Leone to play off one Cold War power against another, and there was a general decline in aid budgets. The end result was that there was a sharp decline in basic services, such as health and education. Teachers, particularly rural school teachers, did not get paid. Primary school graduates, a word which some of you know is used in West Africa, secondary school graduates could not find jobs. People become more aware of acute inequalities based upon this distinction between an elite and the non-elite in periods of recession. And there were many school protests by school children, strikes, and also secondary school strikes. University students went on strike. They tended to be dismissed from their institutions. Rural school teachers complaining about lack of pay were also dismissed. So we find that in the 1980s there developed this growing tension, so that a number of ex-school teachers and students formed the nucleus of a guerrilla force in the deeply forested zone on the ambiguous border between the Sierra Leone and Liberia. And they were aided and promoted by this, by the guerrilla force in Liberia, led by Charles Taylor. Now, if we look at Sierra Leone, we find two great contrasts, that between the capital Freetown and the rural hinterland, and that between the gold and diamond mining areas and stagnant semi-subsistence agriculture. But the problem was that by the middle 1980s, De Beers and other international corporations investing in Sierra Leone had in fact disinvested from Sierra Leone. And in fact, what they were doing was that they were leaving mining in the hands of self-employed small diggers, who received for their work hardly any pay, little more than they would have received as a net income had they been rice cultivators in the subsistence zone. So that these were the discontented elements which gathered round the guerrilla fighting force. In other words, quite apart from all of the elements of symbolic violence to which Renier has referred, we have to understand the root causes and political economy of this breakdown. Now, what conclusions do I draw from this? Well, very basically, to bring my remarks to an end, I would say that specific post-colonial states in Africa have experienced the breakdown of the patrimonial state since independence because of the declining price for their primary products, while at the same time government wealth is siphoned away by the elite to create jobs for themselves and for their children. And this would apply to not just Paul Richards' example, but also to Liberia and to the Congo. Those fighting against these states are seeking, Richards argues, above all, a violent and highly symbolic form of protest, and secondly, a basic redistribution of mineral resources. It will take years of intervention by international organizations to stop the fighting, to encourage dialogue, to begin reconciliation, and above all, to rebuild a shattered economy. More deeply, a common political culture of patrimonialism has itself been shattered in these specific war zones. So that it is interesting that what we are not experiencing in Africa is a mass exodus from all of Black Africa, but flight from specific states experiencing breakdown. The position is not hopeless. At least two African states with strong traditions of education and strong and ancient traditions of trade have recovered from economic and political collapse. These are Ghana in West Africa and Uganda in East Africa. In the meantime, however, I conclude that the only humane way to deal with the situation is that when people with educated and educational resources show the stamina to flee over the desert, they should be given refugee status, and they have the human resources to make a net contribution to their host countries.
Thank you very much. I think your talk has struck everyone. I will say that I have three cousins who are half Sierra Leonese, so it struck me in a particular way. Perhaps you will allow me to just add this, although I very much doubt that there are racists in this room. But two of them are twins. One of them, well, looking as one would expect a half African, half European man to look, and the other one, who died before I could meet him, is said to have had my complexion. And now I pass on the word to Marc Valson, and he will be talking about immigration in a globalized world, and I suspect taking up very much at the point where Paul left off.
Indeed, yes. Okay. Now, first of all, I think it's sort of stating the obvious, but one thing about which there is a consensus in Malta, definitely in this room, and I think in Malta in general, I'll be focusing on Malta in this little discussion, actually, is that refugees and immigrants, immigration, be it refugees or asylum seekers, regular immigrants, whatever, is a social problem. So some of us say, embrace them, sort of as they come in, embrace them, love them, etc. Others say, shoot them, and lots of positions between these two extreme positions. But definitely, everyone agrees that immigration constitutes a social problem. Of course, this doesn't mean that we have to take this at face value. First of all, the idea of social problem, it has two meanings, as all anthropologists know, obviously. First of all, social problems, the term social problem, or problems, can be understood in the sense of problems of society, a problem in society. Society is experiencing a problem, a social problem. But of course, there is a second sense, which should be obvious to all social scientists, and that problems are socially constructed. So a social problem is a problem that is constituted as such by society. And I would like to focus on the second idea with respect to immigration, the idea of social problem, that is, what is the anatomy of this social problem? Why do we decide that immigration constitutes a social problem? Now, I have to warn you that my view on immigration is extremely optimistic, probably. I have the bias that many anthropologists have, a bias that derives from their own fieldwork. I have worked mostly with Indians, with a group of diasporic Indians. They are called Sindhis. There aren't any Sindhis with us today. A shame, actually, because there is a thriving community of Sindhis in Malta since 140 years. But I worked with Sindhis. They are found in over 100 countries worldwide. My last count was 124 or something like that. And in Malta, definitely, but I think this is a general idea, definitely in Malta they have done very, very well. Now, in what sense have they done very, very well? They are established in business, well established, many of them intermarry with Maltese. Now, if that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but definitely that shows a degree of integration, right? So if half of their women, for example, are marrying Maltese boys, then that shows that they are relatively integrated in Maltese society. The link between Sindhis in Malta and the rest of society is seamless. And they have done very well and are still doing very well. So I am slightly starry-eyed about the idea of immigration. I am very optimistic. And indeed, what I shall say today in this short discussion, I think you will find it a bit too optimistic, maybe. But let us look at this idea, social problem, a problem that society constitutes as such. The first thing we should say, I think, about the social problem of immigration is that describing it as such, describing migration, mobility, because immigration, since we are in Malta, but it is mobility on a global level, to call mobility a problem in an age that we call globalized is, on the one hand, anachronistic. On the other hand, they go together very beautifully. But in a sense, it should be, at least, it should be completely anachronistic. Why? There are various features of globalization. There is no one version of what globalization is, but definitely two features that I think all analysts would agree make up globalization, or are part of what makes up globalization, first of all, an unevenness on a global level. That is, globalization, in the age of globalization, we are experiencing maybe more and more unevenness, uneven development. Now, there are various theories as to why, historically, how this has come to be. For example, world systems theory is one set of, or one theoretical approach, Wallerstein especially, the new division of labor theory, mostly German theorists. In any case, there are various theories that seek to explain why the world, as we know it, is uneven. But certainly, I think we would all agree that we are living in an uneven world. That is, globalization affects different places differently. A small statistic, for example, Africa has, all statistics are disputed, but this is one statistic I got from a dependable source, Africa has 1% of trade and investment, of world trade and investment, but 12% of the world's population. This is just to realize how uneven the idea of development is. So I have a situation of unevenness, blatant unevenness. At the same time, we also have a situation of improved or eased mobility. That is, technologies of mobility, of transportation, of communication, have greatly improved. As we know them today, they're excellent, actually, so it's quite easy to take a flight from Africa to Europe or wherever, for instance. Of course, when we take these two things together, we find that it is obvious that given that there is so much unevenness in the world, so much difference, and that mobility is so easy, one would expect people to move. So the idea that we call the calling migration, mobility, a problem is certainly anachronistic, given that there are these two contemporary forces at work, on the one hand, unevenness, and on the other hand, improved mobility, at the same time, very high-profile forces, processes, and still we persist in calling mobility a problem. What I remember from chemistry, it's not much, but what I remember from chemistry, if you have two liquids, one of which is more concentrated, so for example, you have a liquid here that's much more concentrated, right? And here I have a liquid that is less concentrated. If you separate them by means of a porous membrane, a semipermeable membrane, obviously, liquid will move, and eventually they equalize. All right. So, given that we are experiencing uneven development, and given that mobility, that is movement across this divide is relatively easy, we should not be too surprised that people are trying to move from this less concentrated solution, as it were, to the more concentrated solution. Now, eventually, ideally, they would equalize, all right, into two solutions of equal concentration. In order to prevent this, we have to make this divide less permeable, all right? And the way to do that is police, obviously. What we saw happening in Malta a couple of weeks ago, that was an example of, an indirect example, because there are many examples, of making this divide less porous, less permeable. This requires huge effort, of course. It's, I think, similar to the effort that all empires have experienced with respect to keeping out invaders. For example, the Roman Empire keeping out invaders, the Ottoman Empire, etc. Now we have this situation where, at great effort and at great expense, we have to keep this divide. We have to keep it intact. Of course, the problem is accentuated because we have information flowing across this divide. Right? We have information because desire, for example, is, to use a kind of a fashionable term, globalized. In what sense? That is, people living in Africa, which has 1% of trade and investment, are very much aware, because of the media, etc., that in the rest of, or at least in some parts of the other parts of the world, the situation is very different. Okay, there is also a huge flow of information across these borders. So it's not surprising that, given this situation, we have a large scale migration and people attempting at least to move. So, in the sense, to call immigration a social problem is completely anachronistic within the contemporary political economy of the world. I have tried to look at some scenarios, because I always think about this. In what sense is migration a problem? In what sense is it a social problem? For example, one plus point of migration is this idea of the population pyramid. We all know this idea, no? For example, many of the problems we are talking about today, Malta, welfare, etc., that is because we have a population that is distributed in a particular way. So if we have a population that is distributed like this, okay, so you have lots of older people here and less younger people here, productive versus dependent, all right, we have clearly a problem here. And one of the plus points of migration is that, of course, in an abstract sense, and I want to say something about this, in an abstract sense, that would be equalized, all right? The other day I was at the bank, and the bank manager approached me and told me, why don't you invest in a life policy so that I assure my sort of my well-being when I'm old? And I thought that a very good way of not investing in a life policy and still living a good life is to allow more migrants to come into Malta, because of course that would equalize this, and when I'm old there will be more younger people working for me. So that is one of the plus points of migration, but this is in an abstract sense. We have to say something about this. Another plus point of migration is diversity. Now, I don't want to sound sort of like, you know, celebrating diversity and all this. We hear quite a lot on this. But in a certain sense, and definitely in an anthropological sense, we know that diversity, for example, diversity is experienced in cities. I'm using, for example, ideas like the Chicago School here, or Georg Simmel, the German sociologist. Diversity is mentally stimulating. That is, when people live in diverse environments, diverse surroundings, in a human sense, diverse. Even in this room now, we have diversity of many types, but we have also a certain type of diversity that is mentally stimulating. I found from experience, and I'm sure we have all experienced this, that when one lives in an environment which is diverse, where there is difference, one constantly thinks about this difference, what keeps people culturally different, for example, what is culture, these questions that constantly come to mind when one lives in a diverse environment. When one lives in a homogeneous environment, of course, one is inclined to be intellectually comatose. And I think in Malta we tend to suffer a bit from this. And I'm concluding sort of running. Another plus point of migration is connecting, as I said, I'm focusing on Malta, is connecting Malta on a global level. What do I mean? Today, migration, in a sense, has completely changed because of improved communication, etc. Today, migration is not so much an exile; it is a movement. But people maintain contact with their native land. They commute to and from their native land. For example, the reason why at Heathrow there are so many flights to India and to other places is, there are many reasons, but part of the reason is the large number of immigrants, Indian immigrants, living in London and other parts of England, and of course these they need to visit their families, etc. So one plus point of migration is that Malta would be better connected in a human way. That is, I'm using here the ideas of diaspora rather than migration, and also this idea of cosmopolitanism. Today, more and more people are inclined to describe themselves as cosmopolitans. And the more cosmopolitans we have in Malta, the more people we have who represent some component in the diaspora, of course, the better connected we are, not just, but in many ways, business, for example, because Paul mentioned people from Somalia. We have, recently I was at a conference, I can't remember exactly where, did I go to that many conferences, but I forgot exactly where. But someone was talking about Somalis in Britain and the way in which they connect the two countries when they go back. They build, for example, houses in a British style and then in Britain. So this connection, the way they connect, and money as well, capital moving between places. So another plus point would definitely be better connections. In fact, as Paul was talking, he mentioned these three or four examples from Sierra Leone. Was it Sierra Leone called?
Sudan in the case of
Sudan.
Yeah.
Eventually they got asylum in the States.
Yeah. Or Australia.
Yeah, what came to mind is, what a shame, really, because we lost them. Because these were clearly very enterprising individuals. And of course, one reason why, I think, this is my opinion, but one reason why the States is such a thriving country, definitely economically, is that it absorbs these people and, of course, maximizes on the type of connections, the type of diversity they bring in. So, American cities, we always think about them as dysfunctional, as full of crime, etc. But they are also extremely stimulating places to be in and very well connected places. So what a shame. One other example I heard of recently was at King's College in Cambridge. This year, they have a student, part of their intake, part of their undergraduate intake, who has walked all the way from Afghanistan to Britain. Apparently, has very little formal education, but this fact that he actually walked, and of course not just walked, but taught himself as he walked. This was enough to convince the tutors at the selection committee at King's College that this is something that we cannot really afford to lose. So these examples that you mentioned, it is indeed a shame that we lost them to the States. And in this of course, probably they themselves would have wanted to go to the States rather than Malta. So there are various plus points of immigration that we very, very seldom talk about when we talk about immigration, is how to avoid the social problem, how to mitigate this problem, how to make it, but actually we never look at what migration will bring into Malta, how it will change, or how it could change Malta. Of course, there is there are various, actually, as it were, minus points. I'm simplifying here. Usually in anthropology we don't talk about plus points and minus points, all right? But in a certain way, minus points. What are the minus points? For example, here, when I talk about the population pyramid, I was assuming that labor is some sort of abstract entity. In fact, labor is not like that. I mean, people do not just move in to write the population pyramid, as it were. Labor is gendered, it is patterned according to culture, etc. So you cannot just say, I have X workplaces calling the immigrants to fill these workplaces to have a productive population. Why? Because immigrants bring with them life histories, they bring with them particular cultural attitudes, etc. So this is, as I said, very optimistic in a sense, and simplistic way of looking at it, because this is not what actually happens. The thing is much more patterned than that. I was, for example, reading about certain parts of Switzerland where they have quite a lot of immigration. What is happening is that people Swiss people, that is, are moving out of certain areas in cities because migrants are moving in, and these people do not want their children to go to school because of certain real issues. For example, the issue of language, because they cannot speak German or French, the two main languages in Switzerland. And since they cannot speak these languages, the level of education is falling in these schools. So there are real concerns about migration here. We cannot discuss people in terms of an abstract, like an abstract entity, people moving in and filling labor slots. Which is why, for example, there are certain strange phenomena. For example, in Italy, apparently, if you have a baby in certain towns, you get money, you get financial reward. But then, on the other hand, Italy invests a lot of effort in keeping immigrants out. So if you have a new productive member of society, because society needs productive members, you get a financial reward. But an immigrant who is 20, who of course performs exactly the same job, as is kept out at great expense. So why? Because of course the immigrant is not any labor entity, it is also a highly cultured entity. Needless to say, the main minus point here is the idea of cultural harmony. And when people fear immigration, xenophobia, for example, when they describe it as a social problem, because this is what I'm talking about today, I think the first thing that comes to mind is this idea, cultural harmony. How can we live in cultural harmony with immigration going on? Of course, you know that Euripides, Greek Euripides, in 431 BC said that there is no greater loss than the loss of one's homeland. Now, usually we take this as when one moves, one loses one's homeland. But actually, when immigrants move in a sense, you are losing, the native people are losing their homeland as they know it. So there is no greater loss, in a sense, than immigrants moving in and changing the place, you know, in a cultural way. Now, I have some experience. This is my conclusion, by the way. I have some experience of this because I have lived in, among other places, in two places, one being Britain, where there is this idea of multiculturalism, which in my opinion doesn't work. In my opinion, multiculturalism, this is of course a simplified opinion, but in my opinion, multiculturalism, as often practiced in, for example, Britain and the States and other countries, doesn't necessarily work. Why? Because I see multiculturalism as practiced there as actually a way of controlling difference, of minimizing difference, not of encouraging difference, or at least of tolerating difference. In what sense? For example, if you have a group of migrants in Britain, and these migrants happen to wear funny hats or a funny costume or something like that, that is tolerated. That is vibrant, that is diverse, that is welcome, embraced, etc. But if there is a group of migrants, and this group of migrants practices, for example, I don't know, what is seen as discrimination against women or something like that, which is also a cultural attribute, after all, I don't know, or female circumcision or forced marriage or some other cultural aspect, then of course that is described as a social problem. So multiculturalism only goes that far. It doesn't actually allow different cultures to live side by side. What it does is, it says, look, we have different cultures, let us find a means of controlling them. And this idea of multiculturalism. So we have Cherie Blair, for example, wearing salwar kameez and all that. That's the harmless aspect of culture that we can all agree with. The last thing I would like to say is, I have also lived in another context where you have great differences. This was in India. In India, I lived in a suburb of Bombay called Kalina. Now, it was like a bit like Emcida, actually. There was university where I was staying, a youth hostel at university, or student hostel, they call them. Much of a hostel, but anyway. There and around a residential area. And I used to walk through the residential area, etc. And there, they did not practice that form of multiculturalism in terms of encouraging difference, overtly encouraging difference, but they practice a kind of multiculturalism, which is more akin to ignoring the other, rather than embracing the other, ignoring the other. And I think, in a sense, it is much more functional, because these real differences that create so much trouble, for example, in places like Britain, etc., you know, forced marriage, and the BBC website is full of these things on a daily basis. These real cultural differences that really matter to people, they have more space to exist in the multicultural context of Kalina than they do in the multicultural context of Britain. I'm not saying that it is complete. Of course, there are problems. Problems partly created by, for example, politicians. The Shiv Sena of Bombay, which is a right-wing organization that is constantly stirring up emotion against the South Indians, for example, against Muslims especially, of course, and what have you. So it is not a completely fluid situation. But I think if we take all the plus points that I have been talking about, all the plus points, and we say, okay, then let us allow people to move into Malta, and then we definitely have to go for some form of model of multiculturalism. And I would suggest that the model of multiculturalism to go for is the second model of multiculturalism, which is ignore cultural differences. So in a sense, it is a kind of inverted anthropology. Rather than taking an interest in diversity, it is being anthropological by ignoring diversity. In this sense, I don't have enough time because Ranier is going mad here. But that is, in brief, what I wanted to say about this.
Well, thank you very much. I wasn't really going mad. I just assumed that since you regularly migrated to David's territory, you had granted you as I have. So I will still ask David now to behave as though he started speaking 5 minutes ago.
That's fine. I'm not going to use this.
This is recording you.
Oh, I see. Who am I? I'm basically, that's a difficult question to answer, maybe to start out with, but I just want to say that I have a background in law and also in anthropology, and I've spent a large part of my career so far trying to find intermediate areas between the two disciplines where I can apply both subjects. And I want to say that I'm interested in this whole issue of migration as it is evolving in Malta at present, because it seems to me to be an issue which has both an anthropological aspect in the sense of people moving and all the cultural issues that arise, but also a legal aspect. To a large extent, I think we can say that the whole issue of migration has come to the fore in Malta during the last 2 or 3 years. And this is the period from the enactment of the new Refugee Act. So really in Malta we have had two processes going on at the same time. On the one hand we have had the introduction of these mass influxes of migrants, however you wish to categorize them. And on the other hand we have had the process of implementation of this new refugee law, which is meant to, so to speak, regulate the situation. So it seems to me that the whole issue of migration in Malta comes framed and wrapped in a legal and disciplinary packaging, as it were. Maltese are becoming familiarized not only with the idea of migration, but roughly within the same period, the categories of refugee law are finding their way also into popular consciousness. I'm not saying that they are finding their way into popular debate in a pure and untransformed manner, but I'm saying that there is a process by which terms like genuine refugee, terms like illegal, are beginning to acquire certain popularly defined meanings. So what is going on, and what are the topics which seem to me to be worthy of reflection? I mean, in this brief talk, I just want to talk about two topics which seem to me to be interesting. First of all, what does this process, as it is playing out in Malta at the moment, tell us about the nature of the multi-state and the way the multi-state projects itself and legitimizes itself. I'm inspired in asking this question by the work of another anthropologist, Liliana Suarez Navas, who carried out research in Andalusia and Spain on migration. And she observed that, well, there are two points from her book which I find very relevant. First of all, she observes that Andalusia was historically considered as very much a Mediterranean province of Spain, and in a sense as belonging more to the Mediterranean world than to the Northern European world. Following Spain's accession to the EU, she talks about a process by which the boundary of Europe is being redrawn southward, so that Andalusians are now beginning to consider themselves as Europeans, and this of course impacts on the way they regard also the immigrants. We're talking about immigrants who are generally Moroccans who come over quite traditionally to help also with the harvest. So there is a cycle here. And she also observes that in Spain, the state has tried to introduce new laws which are meant to regularize migrant workers. But this process of regularization is carried out in such a way that effectively what the state actually does is to promote itself in the eyes of Andalusians as being, how shall I put it, the epitome of order, of rationality, so to speak, a barrier between them as Europeans and the immigrants, and as policing and controlling this boundary. So in the process of doing this, the state is also changing its image. That is, we're talking about a region where people have traditionally had a certain disregard for the formal state and its laws. And we're talking about a situation which is changing in the sense that people are now becoming, they are beginning to embrace the state laws and the state regularization processes, because the state is presenting itself very much as the defender of the European values of the local people. So the first question I'm asking is this process happening in Malta? Is this multi-state legitimating itself in the same way through law? The second question, I believe the two questions are linked, but I'll try to show how in the conclusion, is how does this phenomenon of immigration provoke, I mean, what kind of debates are being provoked by this phenomenon in Malta, that is, among various sectors, but even among various classes of the population. It's clear that all sorts of reflections about what it means to be Maltese are being triggered off in this debate. So, in a sense, even when we ask the question, are Maltese racist or not? Are we hospitable or hostile? Are we European? Are we tolerant? Are we diverse? We are actually in the process, very often even of defining ourselves as anti-racists, we are defining ourselves, and defining ourselves as a community along certain lines. So, in reality, it seems to me that this process of reflection on identity is being sparked off by this phenomenon of mass immigration. Now, let's start off with the law. First of all, it's clear that when we're talking about law here, we are not talking simply about the level of local law, but we're talking about a kind of legal pluralism or a kind of intermeshing of legal levels, where we have the level of international level, of international law, specifically the 1951 Geneva Convention on the Status of Refugees, together with the 1967 Optional Protocol, and the way in which this international law is being vernacularized, that is, the way in which it is being locally implemented, reinterpreted, embraced. And the main point I want to make about the 1951 Geneva Convention, I'll just very, very quickly quote the refugee definition, because it seems to me to be the important, and it says, of course, well, it says a refugee is a person who, owing to well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, is outside his country of nationality and is unable or owing to such fear is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country. Now, I am not going to go into all the details of this definition. It's a massive task, and I just want to underline one point. The figure of the ideal refugee, as he emerges from this definition, is very much a person who is fleeing from some kind of political persecution because of certain opinions or because even of certain religious opinions. So it is, as many other commentators have observed, a definition which was tailor-made for European refugees, particularly in the immediate post-war period. And it's further attempts to try to develop this definition have failed, largely due to lack of political will. And so we are stuck with it, and people are trying to extend this definition to cover situations which it was never really meant to cater for. So if people fleeing from famine, people fleeing from wars, are not really considered as refugees, the reason has to do also with the law and the way it is framed. And also, I want to point out that the definition is very much an individualistic one. It is not oriented towards groups. It is all focused on an individual who has a particular trajectory which qualifies him to be considered as a refugee. So, how does this international law mesh with local law and local policy in Malta? I'm pointing out that on the local level, the turning point is really the Refugees Act of 2000. Before 2000 in Malta, there was no specific law which dealt with refugees or dealt with their status, and the whole issue of refugees was dealt with in an ad hoc discretionary pattern. It was based ultimately on patronage, on gift-giving, on charity, and various other phenomena which anthropologists have been so good at describing. Now, this system of patronage, gift-giving, discretion was supposed to change in 2000 because 2000 implemented a law, and that law was meant to give people who had refugee status rights. So this was supposed to be the watershed, moving from a system where everything is arbitrary, depending on who you know, depending on whether you find a good patron figure or whatever, to a system where people who are entitled to be considered as refugees now have rights qua refugees, rights which they can assert wherever they go, primarily the right to work, of course the right to non-refoulement, and a few other rights, such as the right to some form of social assistance. Now, in reality, however, what has happened in Malta is that Refugee Act of 2000 has actually continued to preserve a system which is primarily discretionary, and it has been implemented in a way so as to maintain all the lineaments, really, of a discretionary system. Why am I saying this? Because, first of all, while it is true that Malta has a very high rate of approvals of people who are given refugee status, in reality, many of these people are not actually given formal refugee status, but many of them are given a lower level of protection, which is humanitarian protection. This humanitarian protection, going back to the earlier point I made about international law on refugees, is ultimately, it seems to me, a recognition of collective problems, that one comes from a region where there is a war, that one is fleeing a famine, that one cannot return home. But people who receive humanitarian protection have very, very vaguely defined rights and responsibilities. So ultimately, these people who receive humanitarian protection end up dependent very much on discretion, on generosity, on charity. They do not become legal subjects with rights and duties. But they remain in a position of clients of the system. Secondly, even in the case of genuine refugees, people who go through the process and are given refugee status, can I have 5 minutes? I found I had a bit more to say. But even in the case of genuine refugees, I would argue that there is no real process of integration. The state more or less ignores them, it tends to shift the problem to NGOs or to the church, and everyone seems to collude, even many of the NGOs, in the wish that they will just go away. So I do not think that there is any real meaningful attempt to try to somehow incorporate refugees as citizens. In fact, one leading human rights organization called the right to asylum as practiced in Malta a Trompdale, that is basically an illusion. There is the appearance of a right, but in reality there is none. And then, of course, we have to talk about all the people who do not ever attain either humanitarian protection or refugee status, or who achieve this only after what can be literally years of waiting in the detention centers. What can be said about some of the detention centers? I mean, clearly they are liminal spaces. Many of them are ex-army barracks. Khalsaf, which is the main one, which is talked about, most of them are actually located next to the airport. So again, the message is sent, you know, this is not quite Malta, this is a foreign space. And the emphasis on transitoriness is also found very often in the accommodation. We know the famous tents, this idea, you're not here to stay, move on. And of course, the use of delay. Delay is inbuilt into the system and is used in order to basically transform these people from potential legal subjects into objects of charity. So at the end of the day, we are talking, it seems to me, on the, yes, and finally the rhetoric of the Maltese state, as found very often in the discourses of the ministers. What we find is tremendous upholding of human rights in principle, but then in practice, when it comes to the implementation of these rights, we find various forms of exceptionalism. Ultimately, the argument which is repeated over and over again is Malta is too small and Malta is too dense. And of course, sometimes this is added to this is added the other migrant. The other argument, these people don't really want to stay here. They want to go away. Together, these three arguments form a kind of a triangle from which it is impossible to shift the government. So ultimately, government's rhetoric continues to use exceptionalism in order to both maintain upholding the principle of human rights, but at the same time, in practice, to shift migrants and asylum seekers to a discretionary system, where ultimately everything depends much more on benevolence. And the other thing, of course, the state clearly is trying to do is to involve local NGOs and the church in the process, but it is involving them very much on its own terms. That is, it wants to allow NGOs and the church to collaborate, but at the same time, it does not. It seeks to structure the debate and to structure their interventions in a manner which will be neutral and which will effectively avoid calling into question the foundations of the system. Okay, how is, I can only very, very briefly talk about other issues here, but I want to say something about the discourse of the soldiers and the police so far, because the system may be or is about to change. So far, the soldiers and the police have been the main agents of the state, so to speak, in direct contact with the asylum seekers. Talking to them, their discourse ranges from generosity, saying, you know, we look after their children, we bring things for them from home, and actual acts of generosity. And on the other hand, a fear of contamination and a fear of being cheated out of welfare benefits due to the machinations of these immigrants. And this is what one would expect, because they are placed in a situation where they are effectively have really no control over. In fact, I think it's ironical to ask the soldier and the police to address the National Conference on Immigration as occurred recently, because the soldiers and the police are the people who, so to speak, are basically placed in a position where they cannot but complain about the situation. And I really want to say something about the discourse of AIDS workers and NGOs, because it seems to me to be also partly our discourse here in this room. I think we are witnessing the birth of a new, so to speak, enlightened liberal consensus about refugees and asylum seekers. But I want to point out, and you know, I brought some extracts from the Sunday Times, from the Times of the past week, to show how this consensus is emerging, because the idea are Maltese racist, etc. But what I want to point out is that this consensus generally starts off with saying we Maltese are ourselves a diverse people, our roots are in various quarters, and we are a mixed group. At the same time, it's linked to a fear of race, not a fear, a hostility towards racism, which is seen itself as being a kind of a plague that can infect you. This was in the Times of last Saturday. Fascism is a plague that can spread like wildfire. So again, we see the discourse of contamination and cultural contamination emerging now from the standpoint of the liberal consensus. Anyway, this liberal consensus seems to me to be, while I am sympathetic towards it, it seems to me to gloss over the tension between liberal universalism and cultural specificity. That is, are we ultimately going to go, when people talk about assimilation in the same breath as they talk about respecting cultural differences. And it seems to me that the two are not ultimately compatible. So the hard choices which have to be made are often glossed over in the liberal consensus of the NGOs and even of us at university, it seems to me. How does all this... Let me maybe go on to give my conclusion, because I've got a bit lost in my notes. And ultimately, what I want to say is this, that first of all, it seems to me that immigrants are not being offered real citizenship. There's no genuine policy aiming either at assimilation or at multiculturalism in Malta. And indeed, there is no genuine debate on such a policy. Although there was a national conference, that national conference took place, it seems, between selected groups which the state had already selected as its interlocutors. So I question how truly national it was. And I'm not saying that I don't think it was national because it included the opposition. That's not enough. Secondly, it seems to me that the state is legitimating itself in Malta not so much as on the basis of rigorously rationalized laws, on the basis of having an efficient bureaucracy, and on the basis that it protects the rights of citizens as right-bearing subjects. But it is doing so by, on the one hand, stressing its human rights credentials and keeping them formally clean as far as possible, but in practice it is positioning itself as the guardian of the community. And it is, in fact, trying to create a consensus in this way, that is, a national consensus in an implicit policy of rejection and exclusion towards the actual immigrants, coupled with formal, lip service to human rights. So ultimately, it seems to me that we have a situation which is similar to that which Liliana Suarez Navas noted in Spain, in Andalusia, but the state is not so much legitimating itself on the basis of its laws, but it is legitimating itself as the guardian of the community, and ultimately by implicating the Maltese in a discretionary, for perhaps rather paternalistic mode of governance.
Thank you very much, all three of you, for each of you has given us a very condensed talk that I'm sure has left a number of you in a mental swirl. While I give you some time to gather your thoughts together and to formulate your questions, it falls upon me to make some kind of summing up and possibly to see how the various issues you raised might be interrelated. I think, Paul, if I had to sum up your talk in a moral, it would be let us combat prejudice by increasing discrimination. That not unjust discrimination, but discriminating between different kinds of states and different kinds of societies in Africa, and looking at dynamics which might be going on regionally, in a country, and within parts of the country. I think you have also highlighted why it might be important to know something about the background from where the majority of irregular immigrants are coming from. You didn't speak directly about Somalia and the Congo, where most of the immigrants, by far the large majority of immigrants, are coming from. But since one of the issues that arises in the detention camps, as not just as they are currently kept, but even as they might possibly be organized, even if the other conditions are improved considerably. In other words, they might be organized in such a way that might not respect or take sufficient account of detentions that have incited these immigrants to leave their societies in the first place. Mark, I mean, again, always in the spirit of summing up in a phrase or a sentence, I think what you were suggesting were two things. One is that if we are to have a picture of a world society, naturally I offer these summings up as also as implicit questions for you to react to, that if we have to have a picture of a world society, perhaps we can do worse than imagine the North with a capital N and the South with a capital S as working in a kind of dynamic that is analogous to how city and countryside operated in the formation of nation states. The South tends to be the food basket of the world. It is an increasingly peripheral part of the world economy. We might have to make certain mental gyrations to account for Australia and other, but however, Australia is also undergoing its own kind of mental gyrations. It's trying to see if it should define itself as Asian and as a Pacifically oriented, so that is to say Pacific Ocean oriented society. But whether this might be a way of construing the problem, even so that to see if history might tell us something, at least in by way of analogy, of how such issues might be addressed in the sense of how the countryside was addressed in a previous era of world capitalism. The second point you raised is that the model for a secular society might not be the European one in any of its versions, because secularism, because in talking about culture, there is usually an assumption that there is something sacred involved if it needs to be respected, even if it's not religious. That Europe might be too provincial, at least in its experience, because its definition of secularism and its legal experience evolved in the context of addressing usually one religion, possibly two confessions, but of the same religion, whereas a country like India has a wider experience. It has had to be secular, not just in its bilateral relations with the state versus one religion, but also as an arbiter between religions. David, I mean, you, I mean, again, your talk was the opposite of Mark Antony's, not Mark Antony's Falzon, but Mark Antony in Julius Caesar. I mean, he began his speech by saying that he did not come to praise Caesar, but to bury him. In a way, you were saying, I come not to bury the Home Affairs Minister, but to praise him. But by saying the talk is humane, it is of benevolence, the problem is with the grammar of such language, which obscures the horrible consequences, even of the best of men, having protecting you against arrest and the losing of your warrant as a lawyer. I will now would I also like to raise some specific questions with respect to each of you. Now, sorry, I should say that beyond that, you have also, I think, raised two other issues, one of which does address Mark Falzon's idea of the anachronism of preventing free migration across the world. I think your descriptions of how the legitimation of the state in today's world is involved in the setting up of detention camps might explain why, in an age of deterritorialization in many other respects, this kind of territoriality might not be anachronistic, but a symptom of the times. Talking about how these kinds of events and processes prompt reflections on identity by the recipient country and state, I think in some of your descriptions of how Maltese talk about their identity, at least I got a sense that the Maltese set of descriptions couldn't be taken in a straightforward manner. Not necessarily because they were hypocritical or self-serving, but because although they might be authentic as expressions, might be something fetishistic about the characteristics that are highlighted, or if you don't like that phrase, that what is being offered is an effigy of an identity. So my questions would have to do with these. I mean, I wonder, Paul, if you can give us briefly some context about Somalia and the Congo. I mean, perhaps how some of the general dynamics that you showed in a particular way by talking about Sierra Leone might apply to these two countries. Mark, the questions I had when I was listening to you had to do with two things. One, with the benefits for the problem of the welfare gap that immigration might pose. That is the usual problem that is meant when people talk about the welfare gap. It sometimes seems to me, and not just to me, however, that the increasing right-wing drift in Euro-America and in individualism is also due to another problem, which is a welfare problem. The reluctance of people to contribute taxes to paying for the welfare of people whose values they do not share. And this includes lesbians, gays, single mothers. So
maybe unemployed, for example.
So this might perhaps be a complicating factor. The other question had to do with your chemistry model. Now, I am perfectly aware that any analogy or illustration is purpose-specific, and it should be judged only on the basis of the purpose for which it was chosen. However, because I know that you are aware of that, and that you are aware that that model cannot be used for other purposes, because it assumes some of the things you try to combat. It assumes the idea of identity as having a discrete boundary, as something that is of a certain purity which can be diluted. It assumes an equilibrium model. So I was wondering if, in thinking of identity as a process, you had found other images which are helpful.
I'm thinking more about resources.
But it is of the mixing of population and integration. With respect to David, I thought that in your critique there was both a criticism of a certain strand within the Enlightenment, but also a certain strand within postmodernism. I mean, you thought about a world whose legal structures has not caught up with the reality of a global society, not just in the sense that it doesn't cover enough cases that arise, but also in the sense that, for example, it reflects the individualist bias of the Enlightenment. I wonder if that is one of the things you had in mind. The second thing is, it has to do with Marx's talk about an inverted anthropology.
Sorry, your first point is saying that I am attacking both Enlightenment thinking as reflected in the individualist bias.
And now the postmodernist is coming, is being served right up now. It is related to Marx's idea of inverted anthropology when he said, you know, some people don't pay attention to culture. However, I thought that what the multiculturalism that Marx was criticizing, in other words, the Brit one, usually thinks of culture in terms of things which aren't quite serious. That is to say, things you can opt in and out of, like choosing an Italian or a Chinese meal tonight and tomorrow night eating something else. It also has to do with quite often with the realm of play, Cherie as whereas David was talking about the cultural aspect of law, which is enmeshed, embedded, and therefore almost invisible, that we take it as natural. And in this respect, there might be an implicit critique of a certain strand among all those people called postmodernists, who sometimes emphasize the play of culture and the play of difference. But this might have consequences which they themselves might not wish for, even how well-meaning people of another kind would wish immigrants to be integrated. I'm sorry I took so long, but I hope the compensation is that you have had some time to think about issues.
We've added to their swirl of thought.
But I won't ask you to respond now, but I will take a round of questions and then you can...
It's also very interesting to address me the point, but I have to limit myself to one.
I must say I found David a bit more optimistic than even Mark when you say that there is a period of enlightenment in Malta about the issue of immigrants, basing yourself on the letters in the Times. In fact, I'm afraid I don't, getting the Times, you know, like all media, has a policy, and they print mostly the letters which agree with that policy, probably. In fact, I have been, in the past 3 weeks, I have been for personal reasons and electoral reasons, I could say, visiting a lot of people in Balzan, in the Balzan area, families, you know, house visiting and so on, because there are the local elections shortly. And everybody agrees that refugees should be given shelter, nobody complains about the refugee home in Balzan and so on. However, in many cases, you can sense a sense of unease or uncertainty in people when they ask you if the refugees are going to increase, if it's true that the local council is going to build another home for refugees in Balzan, which is not true, but the fact that they ask you means that it's an issue for them. And I think that there are, I mean, what Mark was saying, that immigration is a social problem, actually is true. Not because of any of racism or something like that, but because of, I mean, from what people tell me, two other points, if I may outline them shortly. One is that immigration is perceived as something over which we have no control. It's a phenomenon which happens, and our authorities have no say. We cannot decide how many people come, from where, when, who will come. So this is something which over which we have no say. And for a country like Malta, with a colonial past, the idea of having foreigners, no matter from where they are coming, having foreigners deciding to come to Malta and not asking us, you know, is a sensitive issue, I think. It doesn't matter. There might be Sicilians, for example, because that was also an issue in the European Union debate, that Sicilians would come to Malta, for example. Now, in this case, they are Africans, but it's the fact that they are foreigners coming to Malta, and we cannot stop them. We just have to accept them. And the second point is that this phenomenon is unpredictable for us, at least, because it's relatively new. So we cannot, we don't know much about it, and we cannot say, we cannot forecast how many immigrants will come this year or next year or the year after. Okay, there are, I think, about 800 now, apart from the refugees. But will there be 800 next year or 2,000 or 3,000? Again, both these two points create uncertainty, I think, and insecurity. And this is sometimes, it depends on the person and on the personality. Sometimes this insecurity is expressed as a resentment towards those people who are perceived as causing this insecurity. And this is not really, I don't think this is really racism in an ideological sense. People might talk about immigrants not because they think they are superior, but because they are afraid, actually, of this, because they feel this unease. And there are people, I'll just conclude now. Some people behave in a certain way when they have a conflict or an argument with somebody else. Sometimes when people have an argument, they don't limit themselves to the issue over which there is an agreement, but they will bring up a lot of irrelevant matters. You know, this happens in personal arguments on where there is a group. And people sometimes do that even when they are talking, when they have a disagreement with a group of foreigners. For example, if you have some Maltese talking or disagreeing with Germans, you can be sure that sooner or later Hitler will be mentioned about it. If they are arguing with Sicilians, they will call them mafiosi. Or with Italians about their mention spaghetti and so on. So if they have this sense of disagreement, of conflict with Africans, they will use all the stereotypes and cliches about Africans not being developed and so on. And of course, this appears to be racist, but actually it's not, it's simply a way of people arguing badly, but that's how people know how to express themselves.
Thank you. I'll take one other question in this round of questions, and then I'll ask the speakers to reply. Thank you.
I see a bit of a contrast between the approach of the speakers and the approach of the person who's spoken now. I'm more familiar with, sorry, I'm Antoine. I'm even though I live very close to Balsan, I'm not very environmentally aware. I'm more at home when people talk about policy. On the other hand, I'm very comfortable, I'm very grateful that people analyze the discourse the way that the speakers have done. But it strikes me very much as taking a distance, which we're thankful for, that some people can do it. On the other hand, to have somebody who turns to one side and says, look, you're taking identity as hermetical, and turning to the other one and saying, you're taking identity as as if a culture is something that can be taken, that you can exchange like you exchange from one plate of food to the other. It's a bit of a luxury. It reminds me a little bit of a conference I went to in which they were talking about postmodern literature, and somebody said, I pity the people who live only with one version of reality. On the other hand, the decision has got to be made. And we've also had a criticism of the government as being almost hypocritical, of having different sets of values, talking as if these have got rights but not giving them rights. And then we're being told also that the NGOs, they can't face the decisions. So we've got somebody who's carrying the can and who's got to sort of draw a line somewhere, and the other people who can afford, just like our opposition usually does, to be idealistic. I'm simply noticing the difference between being policy-oriented and being more sort of distant reflection oriented. On the other hand, I think we can be saved from some cul-de-sacs and some conundrums and some traps by people taking a distance and looking at a historical approach and taking the wider view. This is my feeling at present.
Okay, I'll pass in a second the word on to the speakers. If I might just clarify something. As you said, this kind of talk can only take place because it assumes even an intellectual division of labor. I would remind you, of course, that some of the sentiments, including the sentiments that Antoine reported about his constituents, are usually filtered down, out of date theories, which these theoretical approaches are combating. So it is a luxury for the people have to live it, but this kind of discussion is being held because it assumes not that one can go directly from here to policy, but it assumes that we are ourselves social actors in a particular kind of society that can support and then process this kind of thinking further along until it arrives at policy. Okay, so did you have anything to answer, reply?
I'll just be brief. Thank you very much, Ranier. First, Ranier, as regards possibly different dynamics, let me just put it very simply as a possibility for the audience. Let me distinguish breakdown one from breakdown two. About Somalia, about Eritrea, I can say nothing. But with regard to comparing Congo or Somalia with the equatorial rainforest region of Liberia and Sierra Leone, I think comparisons can be made. Essentially, I see that vast republic, the Republic of Congo, as being another variant of the breakdown of the patrimonial state. It too had its great dictator, Mobutu Sese Seko. It too had a political elite which garnered resources to itself and relied on personal followings and networks to distribute resources. It too developed many, many deep senses of social seclusion among the wider population. When the fall in the world price of minerals hit Zaire, or Congo if you prefer, the same thing happened there as happened in Liberia and Sierra Leone. Namely, you had a very dramatic and violent form of staged symbolic process taking various bizarre forms as people fought against the increasing exclusion they experienced from a state which was no longer able to provide even basic services. That's breakdown one. Breakdown two, put very simply, I would regard as being Somalia. Somalia also is a post-colonial state, but it's and it also experienced a drop in its state resources during the world recession of the 1980s and early 1990s. But what makes Somalia different is the fact that there was a reversion to a pre-existing set of political arrangements with which of course the anthropologists here are very, very familiar. We find that the warring pastoral groups really were reverting to what anthropologists called a segmentary lineage system, and segmentary lineage forms of balanced opposition, of divide, rule, and balance of power came into play. It's not as if politics evaporated, but rather they reverted to a particular form of pastoral politics that existed before. Charles, with regard to your point, I don't think what we have here is distanced reflection as opposed to policy orientation. I would say rather that what's going on here is we need to look at an extremely complex issue from a variety of prisms. And what comes across to me from the interesting talks I've heard tonight is that we need to rethink migratory flows. I mean, I'm departing myself from the sorts of human rights discourse which were outlined by David, and rather than talk of human rights discourse, I want to place those within the larger context of migratory flow. We need to understand how they work in different places at different times. And I think this is a beginning. What I'm advocating, of course, is more research. This is just a kind of preliminary to research. We have enough anthropologists in Malta now where we need to go to Safi, we need to go to Halfa, we need to find out who they are, where they came from, we need to gather their narratives. We need to gather their narratives. Finally, Antoine, I like what you say, because you see, I think what's going on is different voices in a conversation. What's happening here at this symposium is one conversation. What happens in the press can be looked at a series of other conversations. The state is elaborating its discourse, but in dialogue with all these forces, an unfolding conversation is taking place. And I think Antoine rightly points out that people, when they engage in discourses, they use bits and pieces, bric-a-brac, which they take from their existing knowledge. Thus, they will say, oh, well, if they're Africans, they're probably fighting each other. I've heard it said. Oh, the Africans at Safia probably are fighting each other hanger and tongs. They're Africans. They're tribalistic. That's the way they think. So I think we all engage. We all use the bits and pieces of our existing conceptual furniture when we engage in these dialogues. And what anthropologists do is just add a little bit more information or perhaps a slightly different perspective in this what I would call, we are engaged in what is an ongoing conversation involving private citizens, the state, the refugees, the immigrants, and many other groups as well.
First of all, thank you, Rania, for an interesting and no doubt generous reaction. I won't take long, because I would honestly like to listen to what people have to say, but we've talked enough, but I would like to combine what you said about experience of India as opposed to the experience of Europe, etc. And it's true, what you said is absolutely true, that I was referring to that, obviously, that India is one example of, in this case, a nation state that has, in a sense, a much bigger wealth, a much greater wealth of living with diversity, because definitely it has to engage in terms of religion, for example, 4 or 5 religions at least, in terms of languages, 14 major languages, etc. We all know the story. So a vast array of diversity. And I would like to combine it with what you said as culture as play, which again I completely agree with you. In my limited experience in India, limited because this is not what I was studying in India, this is, I was living it actually, but I wasn't doing fieldwork on this, so I haven't actually asked people about this. But again, I think that the model of multiculturalism, because it is multiculturalism, because there are many cultures living side by side. But of course, I use the word cultures in an unproblematic way. I realize that there is so much to be said on culture. Definitely, I wish to reify it or to imply pockets of culture. Nothing of the sort. But when I say culture, we all know what I mean here. We have different cultures living side by side. And I think the way they overcome this problem is by ignoring each other. The thing is that you can ignore anything, but you cannot engage anything. That is, if you base a model of multiculturalism on engaging difference, engaging the other, that has its problems, because you can only engage play, the play aspect of it. As I said, rituals, food, etc. You mentioned cuisine earlier. But differences that are much more basic, then we have a problem there. So in that sense, I'm saying ignoring it, living multiculturalism in that sense, ignoring each other, but the exact opposite of what is happening, for example, in at least in rhetoric in Britain. That's all I'd like to say, because I like Antoine's point a lot on the idea of unpredictability and no control over, very true, and there are these ideas of 1 million Africans waiting to make the crossing from Africa and to via Malta. So there are these rumors, 1 million, some say 2 million, some say 50 million. So it's a very hazy. Of course, they're in the desert, which itself increases the mystique, probably not to Ranier because he's worked there, but to the rest of us, the idea of millions of people lurking in the desert waiting to make that crossing, it's definitely a very threatening idea. So definitely, I like your point. But
okay. As regards Antoine's point, I was not trying to give an overview of how Maltese think about immigrants. I was referring to one particular medium, which is very much a middle class medium, and at a particular moment in time, after there has been a sort of fear triggered that Maltese are racist, and so everyone is trying to outdistance themselves by being more liberal than their neighbors. So I was not trying to convey the full spectrum of reaction. What I was trying to say was that both on the part of liberals and on the part of the state, and of course necessarily on the part of those who take the opposite view, there is a kind of shared assumption that Maltese exist as a culture in the community. And part of the process of talking about immigrants involves creating Maltese culture and creating a Maltese community to be defended. I was trying to say that even liberal discourse ends up repeating these tropes, and to me, the parting point was when the Archbishop said, "It is not in our blood to be racist," because for me, it is ultimately, it is ultimately saying, you know.
Did he say that?
Yes.
Ultimately, it shows a kind of, what can I call it, liberal racism. You know, it shows that the very it shows there is actually, I believe, a kind of consensus being articulated among this, around this issue, and it's one, of course, which any policymaker or any government is going to try to act upon and try to solidify. So for me, the whole issue which Charles made about policy, for me, the question I was trying to address is, first of all, why are the real policy choices not being debated, it seems to me, by either side? It seems to me that on the liberal side, we get a sort of either accept all immigrants and just integrate them discourse, or else we get the idea of, well, we must also respect different cultures. And in the process of doing so, they are also defining Maltese culture in a particular way. So the defense of immigrants' rights at the same time is invoking Malta as a community to be defended. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to me that, you know, there are questions which have to be debated. For instance, should we aim to integrate a certain number of immigrants into Maltese society? And ultimately, I was attacking, you know, liberal discourse just as much as I was attacking the Minister for Home Affairs, because it seems to me that it's easy to be liberal. But ultimately, I think some of the more actually intelligent contributions were actually coming quite often from the far right. Intelligent in the sense that they were more, well, maybe not intelligent, but they were posing certain hard questions, which tend to be glossed over when one wants to defend immigrants. So what I was trying to say is basically that also there is something in the way the state relates to Maltese as citizens. To what extent are we considered as right-bearing subjects, really? Or to what extent are we tacitly involved in a kind of system, implicit system of patronage and involve others? I mean, it's not just the state, it's also, is this more the way our community works? And will immigration trigger a change in the way in which we envisage our community and our society?
If I might clarify a phrase which might have been misunderstood, the far right was posing hard questions. I suspect what you meant was the far right was raising questions and issues in which the majority of Maltese would think they see a kernel of truth.
Yes.
Yes.
I quite understand this problem of not being able to problematize enough tonight. I mean, because there are so many issues, and they've been touched upon by so many, in so many ways, and by so many people. I think the whole problem is problematizing. For example, I think there were a couple of binary oppositions here that were being bandied about a bit too liberally. For example, those who embrace the immigrants and those who are completely against them. I don't think there are two distinct camps, quite frankly. One, I think also there's a very important point which has been mentioned by, I think, practically by everyone, but which really needs to be addressed. The whole idea, all our conceptions and our stereotypes about identity, what makes us who we are, whether it's vertical identity, whether it's horizontal identity, and all of these issues, whether I should feel closer to David because he happens to be Maltese and lives on the same island, or whether I should feel closer to somebody else because he seems he has my position on what the multinationals have done in the Congo, for example, and which has also contributed to what has happened in the Congo. I won't take long. I think this whole issue of immigration has exposed us so much, and we haven't started talking about this. It has exposed our prejudices, which we haven't really started talking about. I come from literature, from Maltese literature, and our literature, I love what I study, but our literature is full of prejudices. Even the basic texts we teach to students, we discuss with students at sixth form and at university level are full of prejudices, and we haven't yet started problematizing these issues. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of constructing culture, constructing identity, constructing problems. When the government started, I think the government has played such a big role, and the media also, in constructing this within quotes problem. And I think we have to problematize even our discourse. But we have to, there's so much we can say. I think we definitely need the narratives of the immigrants, and I'll stop here. But we also need to start problematizing our own narratives.
Okay, the lady over there.
Well, what I wanted to add is more or less exactly what you just said about the necessary, or that it's needed to problematize our own discourses, and as well anthropologists. But first I would like to make two remarks, and just one short one to Mark and his idea about this ignoring cultural differences. I think that's really dangerous, what you're suggesting. I think it's really, it makes sense to reassess and rethink the concept of multiculturalism. I think that's totally clear. But I think it's very dangerous to isolate the factor of culture mm-hmm. from other aspects. Just look at class. Mm-hmm. Because culture only works in relation with class, with gender, with religion. And, as soon as you say, okay, let's just ignore cultural differences, it doesn't work.
And it is dangerous, I agree.
Yeah, it's very dangerous.
A politician, for example, can easily manipulate people under certain conditions because precisely having ignored that.
Don't answer yet.
My second comment was a bit more general, and it links to this problematizing of our own discourses. When we as anthropologists use discourses and notions, I think we should be very aware of how we use them. And I had first the problem with you when you said we all agree that migration is a social problem, because with that, sure, it's a social construction, but we reproduce as well things. And that adds a bit like what Paul said later. I don't think that anthropologists just add to common knowledge or to what is said by, let's say, normal people. I think much more our aim should be to be really critical and to question things, and as well question the way we use words, notions, and discourses, and that as well, I think David made this very clear, how political it is as well, which mm-hmm. concepts we use.
Okay. Is there another question? Yes.
Yeah. I just want to refer to the same idea of ignoring. First we have to make a difference between when we have multiculturalism within a state, within a country, and we have such difference of culture within a country. So whenever we have such racism or such between the nationals of the same country, it's not the same thing when you have this multiculturalism is coming with foreigners who do not have the same rights in the country of asylum or something like that. Second is that even if we consider this idea of ignorance, of ignoring the other, if we consider, for example, the example of India, so I would refer to the results happening in India in those attacks and aggressions between communities in India. And we have such approaches to multiculturalism within countries which have those foreign communities. You mentioned Great Britain. In Great Britain we have this coexistence between communities, different communities, but closed communities. While in France, for example, we have this approach of assimilating people, integrating people, and erasing other cultures. While what we need, such other people, they make the approach that we should not assimilate people and erase their culture, but and not accept these kind of closed communities, but try to accept the other and accept also, on the same time, its culture.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? This is the...
I just wanted to follow up David's remark. I think you were the only one that I heard speak about guardian of community. And it seems to me that's an essential part of this debate, not only in Malta, but across the world. And one of the aspects of globalization, for example, is perhaps a sense of threat that particular communities or societies have with the level of change and the level of migration that they encounter, and the issue that might be raised about cultural values on the one hand and the defense of universal human rights on another, or what we might call liberal rights on the other. And it seems to me that this whole issue in this country and elsewhere needs to have that recognized as a political debate of some substance, and that there are that a major part of societies elsewhere is to try to retain and protect a sense of community, and to be able to manage the level of change that they undergo, either at one particular time or over a longer period of time. And the sense of historical memory and continuity in a society too, and in its running of its political institutions and the level of change and so on that can be encountered. It seems to me that, and you see that in France now in terms of how it's trying to deal with what it sees as a secular tradition of what it is to be French, and dealing with one particular, well, not just one, but I think we recognize the Muslim focus of that, but it also applies to headdress and in schools. So this whole issue, it seems to me, is really complicated and interesting, and parts of it have to do with what we might call public rights or rights of a society somehow to feel it can manage to have a sense of what its identity is and how much change it can encounter and on what terms, and the rights that bearers, that migrants have, and asylum seekers have, in leaving untenable conditions and trying to enter into one. So that's why I thought, David, that I really liked your comments, because it brought in this other side of it. And it isn't enough to simply have liberal internationalism with respect to this, that we do need to actually engage this as a political debate.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm actually I'm remembering some of the words that you said, which was that this was a kind of a think tank, a discussion set of proposals. So I'm offering this as a little bit of a critique, if you like, regarding Michael Falzon's presentation.
He is two politicians.
Two.
Yes.
Okay. You actually presented what actually is presented quite commonly, and that's an economic argument about migration. And you even have two diagrams, and I'm aware of your comments about not taking the diagrams out of context, but they are nonetheless economic arguments. And I think that there's a big problem in this, because there's nobody actually mentioned tonight what I think the great benefit of migration is, which is, if you think about what culture is, I think one of the ways of thinking about culture is a technology. And when people bring their own culture into another culture, when they introduce their culture into another culture, they're accessing within that home culture, if you like, forms of technologies which are not there. And that is enriching the culture, not in the way that you're talking about in terms of bringing in foods and stuff like that, but in many ways of coping with realities. You know, somebody said about if you only live in one reality, this is a real problem. Well, actually, cultures are many realities. Even the most homogenous culture is a multifaceted reality. So I think the thing about migrants is that they actually introduce cultural information, cultural material, which is generally not available within that culture, and at that basic level, that's the contribution that migrants make, not the filtering down of economic benefits and the doing of jobs that nobody else wants to do, which is also another traditional... I just want to finish.
Yeah,
another thing is that you also confused the problem of ghettoization and I'm surprised that you didn't mention this when you used the Swiss example of people moving out of suburbs. I mean, this is a well-known problem, not only in Switzerland, it's well-known all over the world where migrants have moved, and ghettoization has been allowed to take place. The best example of that is the United States and the ghettoization of the blacks and the Hispanics. I think that there needs to be, and there are other ways of looking at the way migrants move into different cultures that don't always ghettoize. And there are many other examples where this happens, and they happen, and it happens much more successfully. The third point to reinforce the ignoring cultures critique that you've already received, it doesn't take violence to make the point about how bad ignoring is. The notion of ignoring difference. If you're a member of the Untouchables in India, there's no way you can ignore the cultural realities that are placed around you, the cultural boundaries, what you can and can't do in your life. Not because of people are ignoring you, but because actually culture, Indian culture, has imposed a whole lot of limitations on your life. And it's these different ignorances that you're talking about which are actually doing that. Mm. Nobody cares if you're dying in the street. Mm. Yeah, I think I'll finish there.
Okay, you'll have your day. The final question,
I'm coming from the sciences, I have to admit I'm extremely impressed by the cultural and linguistic eloquence, which I will never try to emulate. I have to say that my initial reaction was a negative one to Paul's comment when he mentioned the fact that these four Sudanese people were highly adequate and intellectually capable and professionally capable as well, and we lost them in some senses to the States. And I started saying, why should we start having biases or selections upon people depending on their functionality or capability. But then, in relation maybe to other comments which I heard from Dave and other people, I started saying maybe, yes, we should, and this reinforces what was possibly what the last speaker was saying, in the sense that we always are looking at the problem with immigration as a problem enforced upon us, even what other people have said, Antoine and others. But the truth is, just like the state selects the best people from other cultures to come and join into its own culture, maybe Malta should start considering doing the same even with the African problem. I mean, after all, most of us, or many of us, have lived abroad or even originated abroad and decided to live in Malta. So this means that if we were to give people the right opportunities to want to settle down here and to bring in their cultural knowledge, we might well be enriching the cultural status. And as we know, one of the main problems with Malta is that we have a very big band culturally or socially of what's the right word to use? Not talented. Low skills. I don't know. Low skills workers. And therefore, the idea of people being forced upon us without some kind of a selection procedure makes people fear more the fact that this band of population is going to increase, and then old people are coming in as well, especially expats from the EU and other places. So we're getting old people who are dependents increasing there, people who are low skilled increasing over here, and it's causing a big problem. As if we were to select people, although it initially sounded horrible to me, maybe it is a positive idea.
Thank you very much. Unless there is no one bursting with a question, I will turn to the speakers and ask them to react as they see fit to the questions and comments that have been made. I'll remind them that the audience has now been sitting for nearly 2 hours here, well, actually 2 hours, so to keep humane treatment in mind. I think ask you to speak first, since you must be the one who is bursting most, given that a number of comments have been directed at you.
Yeah, I've attracted a lot of flack, as I expected. regarding this idea of ignoring, first of all, I have to say that it was a kind of an experimental idea. So what I said about ignoring difference, I said it more in a sense of experimenting with ideas rather than advocating some form of social policy of ignoring difference. Of course, I understand completely that you cannot ignore culture as if culture exists. That was your first point. separated from gender, from class, from other types of. Actually, that was also your last point, that if you are an untouchable, culture also means oppression, etc. I'm not sure that in India no one cares if you die in the street. I'm not sure that India is characterized by constant attacks. But I think that's probably a misreading, or what makes it to the news occasionally. We normally don't hear about people living side by side in Indian cities on a daily basis, but we only hear about it when there are attacks on trains or whatever. But yes, definitely there is a danger with ignoring difference, and I think the great danger is that when there is a politician, for example, a right-wing politician or whatever, trying to manipulate feelings like Sakarai, Shiv Sena, it's very easy to manipulate people then, because they have, of course, been ignoring difference. So I think that's the one danger. However, I'm still not convinced about this. I would still be inclined to defend the idea of ignoring rather than embracing difference, because I think that. I'm not saying this necessarily in an anthropological way, but in more in a sort of, common sense way. I think that when you actually engage difference, you come to a point at which you really can't go further. Whereas with ignoring in a certain sense, living without asking too many questions. That's what I was saying. So, if in Malta there are people who prefer to cremate their dead rather than to bury them, what's it to me? Sort of, as an anthropologist, obviously it's my occupation to understand that. But as a person living my daily life, I can't be bothered about that. That's what I meant. I shouldn't try to understand it, because the minute you try if you try to understand, for example, now maybe I'm mentioning a very dangerous example here, but if you try to understand, for instance, the headscarf, which is the symbol of tensions in Europe, especially, etc., and if you try to understand what's behind it, especially from a certain perspective, of course you come up with gender issues, and of course at that stage you can't engage the other. You have to stop there. You cannot accept the other. But if you just say Muslims believe that women should wear a headscarf, or some Muslims believe, etc., what's it to me? They can do as they please, as long as they don't infringe on my rights. I don't care. That's what I meant, really, not trying to. I find this idea of constantly trying to understand other, constantly. I find it a bit self-defeating, actually. We don't agree here, clearly. And of course...
No, excuse me. This session will continue informally later, but I have to insist that...
I think it's actually important to have a dialogue.
Yeah, no, I think so too, but in view that we have been here for such a long time, the dialogue can continue in later between the two of you, or between more than two of you, but I need to see that this formal dialogue comes to an end.
I wouldn't mind the dialogue either, but I think the chairman is right in given the practical constraints of the session. This is I'm saying this in an experimental way. I'm not saying that this is the only way to think about it. I'm just trying to, not necessarily coming up. This is not the first time we have heard this, but trying to present another model that we can maybe think with. I'm not saying that this is necessarily the way of solving, but I'm just saying, let us try to look at it in a different way, because we have been hearing about engaging difference and about trying to understand it, etc. But it hasn't necessarily taken us very far. Your second point about what anthropologists should do, and I'm honest about this, I didn't quite understand it. Not trying to score a point over you, but I didn't understand it.
Nobody mentioned the fact that what migration actually offered.
Not that one. That one I take on board. I agree with you completely. The technology, the new technologies, yeah. You mean. That I completely accept, I think... No, your second point. Because I had lots of critics. Yeah.
one sentence. It just meant that we should be very careful with reproducing notions and discourses, and perhaps our aim should
to social
to
actors.
Oh, all right, all right. Okay, all right, all right. Yes, okay. I think that's also a fair criticism, actually. I imagined that sort of a contribution like this would attract quite a lot of frowns and all that. But in a way, I'm glad that this has happened, because when we are faced with a different, even in this room, actually, when we try to engage different ideas, that is, including my different idea, we immediately run into a problem. Had you said, sort of, let him say what he likes, and I don't care, it would be much more harmonious, in a sense. Of course, that would defeat the purpose of the seminar, so he did the right thing. But I think in society at large, I think there is something to be said. Not the final word, but I think there is something to be said for this attitude of let others do as they will. As you said, if you are an untouchable living in an Indian city and doomed to collect rubbish since the moment you are born, you cannot quite afford to do that. This is a privileged position to you to say you can ignore difference. So, but please understand that it was an experimental way of putting things. That's my defense, really.
Okay. Anything else?
No one missed. Thank you.
Okay. What I wanted to say is, in response to what you were saying, that maybe there's. I understood that you were talking about the influx of immigrants as being something which acts upon our collective imagination. That is. With the, basically we're talking about immigrants as being a powerful stimulus, forcing people to imagine the community they belong to, or the culture, or whatever. And I suppose what I was trying to point to is a kind of a connection between the way the state projects itself through its laws and through its policies, as the guardian of the community, and the way we all speak about immigrants, and in the process create ourselves as a particular kind of community. That, for me, was what my paper was about. It seems to me that there is a kind of a lack here. The absence seems to me the idea of citizenship based on rights, based on a right-bearing subject, which I don't see as being present in the way Maltese imagine their community, and I don't see it present in the way the state projects itself as a defender of the community. So I suppose that, maybe one positive contribution I would make is that maybe we have to try to think more about how we can imagine ourselves as a community and as a society, and maybe part of this, one of the benefits of immigration is that it is forcing us to confront this in a very direct way, because there are practical choices we need to make.
All right, thank you. I want to thank the other speakers, and I want to thank the audience very much for their participation tonight. To remind you that an email list is going around, if you wish to sign it, you can be in touch with me or with one of the other conveners, because in May, or in October, we would be able to schedule what would effectively become the sixth seminar we've had in the last 2 years on the whole issue of immigrants and refugees. This is an ongoing project, so please give us your ideas by email. With regard to some of the interventions of the audience, I'll just make 3 points. First, hermeneutics. Is anthropology really a question of critically rethinking concepts and categories for analysis? Is anthropology fundamentally a hermeneutics? I'm not of that persuasion myself. I think we need lots more information. And I would go on from that to make the further point that if this is being very empirically minded, to make the further point that it seems to me that part of the problem with an abstract discourse in human rights is that it can be a very two-edged sword. under the rubric of an abstract discourse of human rights, you can do all sorts of things. As David has tried to point out in certain specific ways, you can exclude people. We might say you can bomb people. You can introduce democracy and new forms to people. Let me say I perhaps would prefer a rather more old-fashioned British conservative approach to the constitution of the human person in terms of human needs rather than in human rights, which would lead me to my other point, which is that I take your criticism that there is a functionalism involved in the approach in my talk, and that you're querying whether or not I'm inspecting refugees to see what they can contribute to a community. And of course, the simple answer is yes, I am. And I am saying that they can indeed make a contribution. And if there were circumstances where you could tell me that they could not make a contribution or were indeed dangerous for the community, then I would say there were grounds for exclusion. I'm saying we need to know a lot more empirically. We need to generally rethink migratory flows. And just a final comment, which comes out of listening to the discussion between David and the audience, would be something like this. It seems to me that one of the effects of the Safi events, in which, as it were, immigrants did stand up for themselves, they did protest, and there was a violent altercation with the police, is that in a sense it has added to the conversation. We now have had a national conference. We are having more symposia in which people do rethink and re-problematize identities. So I do see this as an unfolding and widening conversation. Thank you.
Well, I would like, first of all, to thank all three speakers. Usually anthropologists are professionally very much concerned with culture in flagrante delicto, and you have managed to capture culture in several compromising positions tonight. The members of the audience too, I think, added enormously to the debate. I mean, some of them might say that the compromising positions involved one or two of you, but from the experiences of people, I mean, whether as policymakers or as electoral candidates or as someone teaching Maltese literature, I think what we got was, in the first place, a sense of Maltese people who have a dualistic attitude towards the immigrant problem, between scare quotes. That is to say, they are troubled by it because they are troubled by some of their own reactions and thoughts, whether they're liberal thoughts or they're illiberal ones. The other speakers were, I think, trying to prompt us to towards trying to see if the values, or at least the ideals, of the majority of voting people in Malta, as opposed to the people in Malta, could perhaps be lived out in a more realistic way. That is to say, in a way that somehow could be made more congruent with the actuality of the world of which we form part. Some of you, in fact, I think, suggested that this wouldn't be possible without changing the exchange rates of our values. That is to say, having a transvaluation of values. That is how I interpreted the thrust of the two comments, of the two sets of comments coming from there. But in any case, thank you all very much, and hope to see you when this seminar next convenes. Thank you. Good night.